This morning, Derek Finkley is going to speak to us about decision making. Derek is a deacon and secretary in the Mascot Christian Fellowship. He also leads Bible studies there and is very active in that assembly. He's married. He also has three children. He received a BA with honours from Sydney University, and he's the assistant director of New South Wales Department of Lands. He knows how to get with the right people, doesn't he? But he's come this morning and he's going to speak to us about decision making. Thank you, Derek.
What is decision making? Well, we do it all day, every day. It's what human beings are supposed to do best. It's really the way we think about things. And so it's a very hard topic to talk about because we can come at it from so many different for different angles. What I'm going to do today has got a bias in terms of decision making. I'm going to talk about that kind of thinking which seeks to achieve goals and objectives, to solve immediate and potential problems, and to carry out day-to-day functions or activities. So the type of decision making which we're going to look at is a deliberate, logical process, and it's one that often has a number of discrete steps. But I have to say that not all cultures think about problem solving or decision making in quite that way. It's a cultural thing. So while the sorts of things that I'm going to talk about today can be readily grasped, I guess, by everybody in the audience and can be applied, we have to be sensitive when we're dealing with people from different backgrounds, from different cultures, different ethnic groups, because often they don't think in a logical, structured way. And so we can't expect that of them, and we have to sit and learn. So while I don't want to explore that particular theme today, I'm conscious of it, and you need to be conscious of it too if you're dealing with or trying to provide for people who come from different backgrounds. That's a problem which is classic to all missionaries. Now, the sort of presentation I'm going to give has often been criticised by people such as Mr. De Bono, who says, well look, this is just the sort of thing that comes from the left hand side of our head. You know, it's people who read and do things in a logical, sequential way. We've got two sides to our brain. There's the other side, which is working on intuition and so on, impressions. That's also important in decision making, and that's true. Decision making is something that is separate from intelligence. It's an art that you can learn, and it's also a discipline that you can study. So with those sorts of introductions in mind, I think we can start getting a feel for the sort of way in which we're going to take this particular discussion. First of all, I'd like to identify three kinds of different decision makers. See how we go with our overhead projector. Now, the first type that we can talk about is ourselves as an individual. We make decisions on a day-by-day basis, and the process of decision-making is highly personal, and it's not there for people to see. We see the results of those decisions. We don't actually see the process of the decision being made by the individual. And the rules for decisions made by individuals are not the same as those for either organisations or society as a whole. So it's quite a separate area. And that's the area that I want to focus on particularly this morning. The second area, which we'll also give consideration to and which will be covered more in the discussion, is about group decisions. How we as individuals, when we come together, make decisions, and how organisations themselves make decisions. In other words, the way in which organisations grapple with their decision-making process is more than the sum of the individual decisions which are made by the people who work within those organisations. And finally, there is perhaps the most intriguing area of decision-making, and that's relating to how communities or societies as a whole make decisions. Right. Now, this takes us into political theories and to understanding social change. And it's a very interesting area. And one that if I strayed on as a public servant and talked about a current offence, I'm sure I'm likely to get into some trouble. So I'll stick to the first one, a realm that we all understand, and then start making reference to the second area in the course of my talk. Right. Now, in terms of the decisions we make on a day-by-day basis as individuals, some of them are very trivial. When we get up in the morning, I don't think we ever think about all the choices that we have to face us during the day, otherwise we wouldn't get out of bed. I know my sister had a girlfriend whose mother, whenever the day got bad, just went back to bed and drew a line under the day and said, well, that's it. And I guess a lot of us feel that way. And if you think about when you get up in the morning and you put on your clothes, there, depending on how many clothes you put on, how cold it is and so on, and what you're wearing, that you've probably got several thousand different ways in which you can put those clothes on. For example, I could come and put my shirt on and put my singlet on. And I'd have to make a decision about that. Well, fortunately, much of our decision-making is not on that sort of level. But at the other end of the spectrum, there are many decisions which are critical. And we, throughout our life, we come across critical phases of whether we stay or we leave school, whether we take a particular job or not, who to marry, which is quite interesting because at our church at Mascot, we had a very wise and revered speaker come to us one day, and he said to us, which set us back on our heels, really, God isn't really interested in who you marry, it's why you marry the person that's important. So that took a bit of thinking about. So there are some critical decisions that we have to make in our life. But if you take that last point, it's the basis on which we make those decisions which is important. We need to make a decision about decisions which are made in good faith as opposed to decisions which are made in bad faith. Now, as Christians, irrespective of whether it's in Christian work or whether it's in our own workplace, we've got this challenge before us that the logic on which we make our decisions is different from those of the people about us. And that's critical. Now, to illustrate that point, I want to read a number of sections from a book by Machiavelli. I don't know if you know the phrase, oh, that person just being Machiavellian. Well, it means a person who's being tricky or is deceiving other people. Machiavelli was born in 1469 in the city of Firenze, which is, we know as Florence in Italy. And he was a public servant, like I am, but I hope I don't share too many of his attributes. He experienced just about all of life's ups and downs. He led armies, he advised the highest in the land, and he spent some time in prison where he was tortured. And he ended his life living on a farm with a wife and six children. So he knew all the ups and downs in life. And he wrote this particular book entitled The Prince, and he gave it as a present to the ruler of Florence as a gift to influence him. And it was to guide him, this Leonardo di Messi, I can't pronounce Italian names, so I'll give it a miss, on how he should make decisions in the context of warring states. And it's been long seen as an example of how to make decisions in bad faith. So let me just read an extract. If you haven't read any of his works, I commend it to you, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. How princes should honour their word. Everyone realises how praiseworthy it is for a prince to honour his word and to be straightforward rather than crafty in his dealings. Nonetheless, contemporary experience shows that princes who have achieved great things have been those who have given their word lightly, who have been known how to trick men with their cunning, and who in the end have overcome those abiding by honest principles. A prince is forced to know how to act like a beast. He should learn from the fox and the lion, because the lion is defenceless against traps, and a fox is defenceless against wolves. Therefore, one must be a fox in order to recognise traps, and a lion to frighten off wolves. Those who simply act like lions are stupid. So it follows that a prudent ruler cannot and should not honour his words when it places him at a disadvantage and when the reasons for which he made his promise no longer exist. If all men were good, this precept would not be good. But because men are wretched creatures who would not keep their word to you, you must not keep your word to them. And a prince will never lack good excuses to colour his bad faith. One could give innumerable modern instances of this, showing how many pacts and promises have been made null and void by the bad faith of princes. Those who have known best how to imitate the fox have come off best. But one must know how to colour one's actions and to be a great liar and deceiver. Men are so simple and so much creatures of circumstance that the deceiver will always find someone ready to be deceived. A prince, therefore, need not necessarily have all the good qualities I have mentioned, but he should certainly appear to have them. I would even go so far as to say that if he has these qualities and always behaves accordingly, he will find them ruinous. Now, I'm not reading that passage to suggest to you that that is how we should behave, but we need to know that that is how the world behaves. So the two things that come out of that: first of all, we should steel ourselves against taking the way the world looks at things, but secondly, to be aware that that's the way it deals. Let me read just one last section. It's fascinating stuff, and I'm sure if you've been following events at a federal level, particularly the likes of Mr. Tuckey and so on, you'll know that they must have been reading this self-same book. He goes on about how flatterers must be shunned. But when seeking advice of more than one person, a prince who is not himself wise will never get unanimity in his counsel or be able to reconcile their views. Each counsellor will consult his own interests, and the prince will not know how to correct or understand them. Things cannot be otherwise, since men will always do badly by you unless they are forced to be virtuous. Now, that's the difference for us. We're not forced at all to be virtuous. We do it by faith. So that's the thing I wanted to stress to you, that in the decision making, even though I'm talking about a logical process, it has to be based on good faith if it's going to be pleasing to God. Right, now let's turn to the next element of decision making. We need to distinguish between wants and needs. Now, it's very easy to get the two confused. I want you to think of two circles and keep them in your left and right hand. Now, when those two circles completely overlap, our wants and our needs, we don't have any conflict. Life's easy, we can make the decisions and go on. But as soon as those circles start to drift apart, when our wants are different from our needs, then we get that kind of stress that is very difficult to resolve. And unless we concentrate on what we need to do, as opposed to what we want to do, then we've got some real problems. I want to give two examples about this. One from the Bible in the Old Testament, and I'll give a number of those as we go on in our study, because the Bible has got many examples of both good and bad decision makers. And I must say that I've learnt more about decision making from my mistakes and those of others than I have about getting things right for myself. And so I'm going to give examples of people who have made mistakes, but there are people in the Bible who have been good decision makers, such as Nehemiah and so on. There are lots of examples I could draw on, but I'll draw on some mistakes. And I also want to draw on some examples from my own place of work. Now, the Department of Lands, in its land administration, provides land for all sorts of purposes, and we also undertake construction work for recreational purposes and other land management tasks. And one of them, for example, is the construction of walking tracks. We have one that goes on the other side of the mountains, further south, which traces the Human Hovel expedition. It goes for something like 400 kilometres, and it's got something like 19 individual points where people can camp. Another such walking track is at Cape Byron, which is the most easterly point of Australia and New South Wales, and it's very heavily used and has about 500,000 people a year who go over various sections of that track. I remember one day going up there when it was being constructed, and I noticed that some of our staff were doing things which I thought was inappropriate. And I realised that we had surveyors who should have been doing the more demanding planning and design and supervision work, cutting the lawn, digging the ditches and so on, because they liked doing that kind of work. That's what they wanted to do. Their job, that wasn't their job, but that's what they wanted to do, and they were neglecting the sorts of responsibilities they had. They weren't paid as surveyors to do that kind of task, although that task was important in its own right. And the more I look around the department, I find that there are people, in fact, who tend to spend their day doing the things that they want to do rather than things that are needed by the organisation. People will draw plans, the most elaborate and detailed plans of land use activities. Beautiful works of art, but they're not really needed. And so it's very costly to the organisation and to the community if that's allowed to continue. Let me turn to a real example then from the Bible, and if you've got it, your Bible with you, you might turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. You might recall that there came a time when the people living in the land of Israel came to their leader at the time, Samuel, and said, "We want a king." And he said, "Why do you want a king?" And he said, "Well, we want to be like everybody else. And we want to have someone who will go before us and who will fight our battles. That's why we want a king. We want someone to lead us." Well, they ultimately found a leader in Saul. And you might remember the decision-making process that led up to that. Saul had been anointed by Samuel, but they cast ballots as a way to affirm God's choice. And when they finally cast the last ballot, having gone through all the tribes and so on, and the families of the individual, they couldn't find him. Where was he? He was hiding in the baggage, some leader. He was then replaced because of some inappropriate decision making, and David became the king. And in chapter 11, verse 1, we read these words. "In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem." That's why he had a king. He was there to lead them, to go out to battle. Where was he? He was cooling his heels in Jerusalem, having a good time. I won't go through the entire story because I think you know it pretty well. What happens is that he ends up having an affair with a woman, and disaster strikes, because if you follow the logic of the story through, it ends with the death of his sons, his own sons, bar Solomon, at the end of the day. And so this was the start of a tragedy, and it came about because David was doing what he wanted to do, not what he needed to do as the king. And so there's a classic example of someone who was not paying attention to what was really required. And so if we don't, in our day-to-day activities, focus on what we need to do, and we concentrate on our wants, then the objective of our organisations won't be progressed. I want to then now turn on to some rules of thumb, if you like, that can help us in our decision making. And the first one that I want to talk about is the 80-20 rule. I don't know if you've ever heard of the 80-20 rule. It's just a sort of a convenient phrase we use to convey a particular breakup of events. And I can illustrate this 80-20 rule best by giving some examples again. And that is 80% of the decisions that you have to make for your organisations are unimportant. But 20% are important. And the trick is to find out those 20% and focus your energies on those. Now, I received in the mail, as they want to do, an executive bulletin, which of course everybody in the organisation tends to read. And it's to encourage us to be more diligent and so on. And in this particular one, it gave a classic example of the 80-20 rule. And it's, wait for it, from Mr. Dick Humphrey, who's the Director General of the Premier's Department. And he was talking about the way in which we're changing the budgetary process in this state. I don't know how other states are, but New South Wales, we're in debt as much as anybody else. He says here in this particular example, "The situation in New South Wales is that 83% of claims that are processed by public servants are under $1,000. 83%. And account for only 6% of the total values of the outlays." So we've got enormous numbers of invoices going through government agencies, and 83% of them are worth less than $1,000. Right? And they're only, when you add them all up, worth 6% of the total outlays. "The introduction of random checking for these will save $15 million a year and allow greater attention to be given to the 17% of material claims, which account for 90% of our outlays." That's an example of the 80-20 rule. "The Commonwealth found that 88% of its claims were for less than $1,000, and changing the method for checking these saved the government $50 million a year. What we hope to do is to spot check the 83% of claims under $1,000. But this system would be implemented in conjunction with other mechanisms, so don't you worry, it'll be all looked after." And so that's something we need to be aware of in our decision making, that there are all sorts of decisions that we have to make, but there are only some of them which are critical. Another example that this use of this rule of thumb, try as we might, 20% of our decisions are bound to be wrong or second best. So that's something we learn to live with. Why is that? Well, because we don't often have all the information that we need to make decisions. Or it may well be that events change so that the decision we thought was appropriate, when it comes to being implemented in the fullness of time, tends to be wrong or inappropriate. Now that's a reality, and it's something we need to be aware of. What is important, having realised that, is how do we institute damage control when we've made the wrong mistake? Now, the first thing that we've got to do as individuals is to admit that we've made that mistake and to take corrective action. One of the greatest difficulties we have in organisations is to get people to realise when they've made a mistake, let's admit it and correct it. I can remember one of the most embarrassing situations when this occurred was during a period of time when there was a housing crisis, not the current one, but about a decade ago, and I worked for the Minister for Housing at the time, and we were preparing a cabinet minute which gave a number of options that the government considered to address this particular problem. And we were coordinating information from a number of government agencies, and it happened that one of the pieces of information we got in was absolutely wrong, and it just destroyed the whole argument that was in the cabinet paper. And we came on this, and what do you do? The paper had been circulated, other government departments had it. The only thing we could do was go to the minister and say, we got it wrong. Well, he said, thanks for that. You don't make me very happy, but I'd be very much more unhappy if I went before my cabinet colleagues and they told me that I was wrong because of this assumption that you'd made. So what's important is we've got to realise that when we make decisions, we will make mistakes, but that we need to try and control the damage by admitting that that's the case. Now let's have a look at some of the types of decision making that we're going to confront. Now the first one might look to be a little bit strange. I've called it non-decisions in terms of avoidance or indecisions. But non-decisions themselves can be very important from time to time. We get to stages where we have to adopt that as a decision-making tactic, not to make decisions. Now in the same context that I've just referred to of housing policy, during that period of time there were a large number of cabinet meetings, and these were chaired by the Deputy Premier. And at one of these meetings, as a junior official, I was sitting behind the circle watching them deliberate, and a particular paper had been put up by a minister, and he was desperate to get endorsement to the particular proposals that were coming forward. And it became quite obvious that the Deputy Premier, who was Mr Jack Ferguson, was not going to bear a bar of what was being proposed. And so after it had been discussed for some time, he said, come on, let's move on to the next agenda item. And the minister said, hang on a minute, what did we decide? And Ferguson said, we've noted it. Moved on. And that was a non-decision. He didn't say yes and he didn't say no. He just said, I've noted it. And there are some times when we're making decisions that we're going to have to defer them for all sorts of good and bad reasons. So we need to recognise that that's happening. And we often find that in the workplace, that people will try and duck shove things. They'll let other people do it and they'll avoid that. But if we're going to be effective, we have to be able to recognise when a decision has to be made and whether we can make it there and then. Then we get to what we call intuitive decisions. I mentioned that most of the time in this discussion we'll be looking at not working on that right side of the brain. But we need to recognise that if we get a gut reaction about something, it may well be right. Now, if we base all our decision making on our gut feelings, we'll probably make our fair share of those 20% mistakes. And the ones we make can be horrendously wrong. But there is a real basis in intuitive decision making. And what I've found from my experience is that if my intuition tells me that a certain course of action is the right one, I try and say, that's the decision, or that's my conclusion about the matter, and then I try and go around it and test it by other means. So intuitive decisions can be very, very valuable, and they're the ones that can give us the spark and to get us over a bridge that we wouldn't get across by other means. The third area of decision making is logical or analytical decisions, and this is the core of what we do. For example, some of these can be broken up, and there are all sorts of classifications of these kinds of things, of non-mathematical versus mathematical. Now, the example of mathematical is easy in terms of the way we do budget process. If we're going to build a structure, say we're working with a campsite, we need to put in certain facilities, well, just working out what's required, adding it all up and so on, they're examples of mathematical decisions, and they can become even more complex. Now that we've got computers which are readily available, you'll find that there are going to be programs which are going to help us do all sorts of things. And so many of those will be based on mathematical principles. But much of what our decision making is based on non-mathematical. But that doesn't mean to say that they can't be as rigorous or as well defined. And so to the extent that we can, I'm suggesting to you that there are great benefits from being systematic in the way we make our decisions. Finally, I've just identified what I call routine decisions. I've been rebuilding my house to make it more habitable and so on to suit our family needs, and I've had a number of tradesmen coming through the house, and I've found it a great joy to work with them and to watch how they go about their tasks. And there's nothing like watching the rhythm of a bricklayer, right? He makes these decisions and they just come as routine because he knows exactly what he's doing. And routine decisions can be very important because what they're based on is prior experience. And so what we need to enable routine decisions to be worthwhile is to have a good policy framework so that we know when they're appropriate. And for example, in this last week we've had the people putting in the kitchen, and to watch the guy who was putting in the kitchen cupboards, he had everything down to a fine art. All the major decisions he had to make were now a matter of routine. But of course, nothing ever goes to plan, and there were a number of key things that he had to struggle with, and that's what took most of his time. But he was able, in a sense, to make these routine decisions again in terms of the 80-20 rule. 80% of his decisions were routine, he'd come across them before, only 20%. And I'm sure in your own experience that you can set yourself up when you're efficient to be in that kind of mode. Let's have a look then at some barriers to decision making. I've now lost a particular slide, so you'll have to bear with me while we just go through that. I've identified in my discussion some six particular barriers to decision making. The first one is that people can often fail to make decisions when they should because of insufficient authority. Now, one of the things that we have in our department is a list of delegations, and because the Crown Lands Act that guides our operations is a very complex one, there are something like 500 different matters, decisions that can be made, which start with the Minister, but obviously he doesn't want to make all of those for us, so he delegates them. And they are all delegated down the line to people, and this, our Bible if you like, a Manual of Procedures, has a section on delegations which itemises who can make what decisions. And that's to enable the organisation to operate efficiently. Everywhere you go, you'll find those sorts of things. Now, that's what's important, to look at your own organisation and ask, have I got the authority to make the appropriate decisions? If you don't, it can be a real barrier. The second one is fear of making mistakes. Some people will do everything in their power not to make a mistake, not to make a decision in case they make a mistake. Well, as I've said, even with the best will in the world, we're going to make mistakes anyway, so we've got to try and put that fear behind us. A third area where we can create a barrier for ourselves is lack of information. Right? And we often say, I really don't know enough about that to make a decision on. Well, that's no real excuse, because there are such good sources of information that are available to us that we should go out and look for it. Another area is perfectionism. Some people just say, well, if I can't do it properly, I'm not going to do it at all. And again, it's a question of judgment as to how perfect something should be in terms of the task at hand. If it's going to achieve the objective, then it'll probably do. Another one that is perhaps more critical, and one I want to give an example again from the Bible, is about impaired judgment. There are circumstances in our lives when we're called to make decisions and we're not in the right frame of mind, or we're not in the right physical condition, and our judgment is impaired. And it's important for us in our day-to-day work to recognise the symptoms. I don't know about your biorhythms. It's unfortunate that my biorhythms are best early in the morning and late at night, or later in the afternoon, and I find that's when I'm travelling. And I would really like to restructure my life more on a European mould, where you go to work very early in the morning and then you have the middle of the day off and you sleep and then you go back to work. We don't organise ourselves like that. You know, if you can do that, that would be wonderful. And I find that my judgment is far better at some times of the day rather than others. And so you need to be aware of that. But let me look at an example of impaired judgment from 2 Samuel chapter 16, I think it is. Again, this involves David. As I indicated, after his affair with Bathsheba, things start to unravel over the following years, and eventually we find that his son Absalom rebels against him, and he gets to a situation where David has to flee. And in chapter 16, I'll just read the first 4 verses and we'll just go back to the context to fill it in, and I'll indicate why it was an example of impaired judgment. When David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth, waiting to meet him. He had a string of donkeys, saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisins, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. The king asked Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who have become exhausted in the desert." The king then said, "Where's your master's grandson?" Ziba said to him, "He is staying in Jerusalem because he thinks, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "All that belongs to Mephibosheth is now yours." "I humbly bow," Ziba said. "May I find favour in your eyes, my lord the king." Now what was going on here was that David had to flee from the city, and he did it in haste, and he was now physically tired, and he was stretched. And a man turns up, and he's got the resources to assist these people who were with David, to give them some refreshment. And David says to him, "Righto, thanks for that." And as a reward, he makes a judgment and says, "When I come back as king, after I've sorted out this problem with Absalom, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is now yours." Now, if you know just briefly what the story was, Mephibosheth was a son of Jonathan, and to repay the love that David had for Jonathan, he had restored Mephibosheth to his household and had provided certain estates for him, and Ziba was Mephibosheth's servant. If you go on to find the story, when David does come back into power, he suddenly finds out that Mephibosheth may not have done what Ziba said. So perhaps David should have been thinking about the sort of advice that Machiavelli had given so many centuries later, because Ziba was a crook. And that's what happened, because David was tired. He didn't need to make the decision. All he needed to say was, "I'll remember you when I get back to power." But he didn't. So here's probably an example of impaired judgment, and one where a non-decision probably was appropriate. So that's a barrier to decision making. Some are good, some are bad. The final one that I'd like to raise as a barrier to decision making is wishful thinking. We often start to be like the people who do, can't think of his name, the other great character who was always engaged in wishful thinking instead of thinking about what he had to, and that becomes a real barrier. We've already talked about that in terms of needs and wants. Right, now let's then talk about the decision-making process itself. I've given you a handout which you can look at rather than perhaps seeing the overhead projector. It's clearer too. And we'll talk about this process I've identified six steps that you might like to think about in terms of your own way of tackling decision making. There's no reason why these have to be carried out in a particular order. I've just found it useful to group them in this particular way. The first of all is we need to determine the purpose of the decision. It's important to determine the specific nature of the decision, the what and the why the decision has to be made. Often we find people coming along saying, oh, we've got to make a decision about whatever it is. And you have to stop and say, why is it? Why have we got to make this decision? Now, one of the interesting things that I've come across is that the former head of the Premier's Department in New South Wales was a man called Jerry Gleeson. And he was a very shrewd man. And he always, when someone came to him and said, oh, we've got to make a decision about something, he always asked, well, what's the downside? And if there was no downside, he wouldn't make a decision. It wasn't important. And so he wanted to know what the purpose of the decision was. Did it have any significance? And if it was important, then he would start thinking about, well, who should make the decision and how should it be made? Second part of this is determine when the decision must be made. We need to recognise that for some particular decision to be made, we have to make prior decisions and we have to sort of get the sequence right. In many cases, judgment is best withheld until the issues crystallise. And I think we've given some examples of that. The third step in this logical chain is to determine how the decision should be made. Now, a judgment is often required on whether a decision should be made independently. Right? Is this a decision that I can make on my own? Do I have the authority to do this? Should I now make that decision? Or should I make it with the assistance of others? Should I go and get advice? Or should I make this decision in collaboration with other people because perhaps they're stakeholders in this enterprise and they'll be affected by this particular decision? This third is the most critical part. It's a decision in its own right. And this is where we often get lots of conflict, particularly in community organisations, when somebody sees something and says, oh, I've got to make a decision about that. Bang, makes a decision. And what do we find? Everyone else says, what did you do that for? First thing they do, what did you do that for? Often just taking the time to collaborate with others often brings a better decision and one which is acceptable to others. So I've said this little sentence at the bottom of that section, note the value of locking in key opinion makers. And that was what Jerry Gleeson always tried to do. He not only looked at the purpose of the decision, but how could I lock in other people and get them to make the decision? And it'll be a better one because they identify with it. Fourthly, identify what you need to know to make a good decision. Right? There are good and bad decisions. Some are better than others. And we need information, but there's a danger. If we try and collect too much information, we end up being confused. So we need to identify, on the one hand, what is a good decision, what's the right sort of decision, and what information we need to bring it about. Fifthly, we need to identify alternative courses of action. Right? Very rarely do we get to a situation where there's really just one course of action. That's easy. If you are constructing something, you look up the specifications and they'll say, right, you need a bolt of a certain size, or you need a certain piece of material, or if you're cooking, there's a recipe that says, if you're going to make a souffle, that's the way you make it. In our real world, we find that there are many different ways, and what we need to do is find alternatives which are different and capable of implementation. No good thinking of alternatives which aren't capable of implementation. And finally, we need to assess the merits and consequences of each alternative course of action. We've got to weigh them up. We've got to rank them. And that's what I tend to find most of my time spent on. People are bringing to me alternatives and I have to try and see just how they all line up. And that's not easy. We find that some of them are really, based on flipping a coin. And that's not a bad way of doing things. At the end of the day, if things are appear to be equal and you're indifferent between them, well, why not? If you've got nothing better to do, it seems to me that's as good as any. So there's six steps. I'm fairly cold-blooded when it comes to those six steps. Six steps in a decision-making process. As I try to indicate at the start that's a very logical, you know, disciplined way. Right? Now, obviously, if it's a small task, you don't go through this elaborate process. I must determine why I'm making the decision. When am I going to make it? You know, it's when you get to those 20% of decisions which are critical that you take the time and effort to force yourself to go through certain steps that you'll get a real payoff. And all that's been fairly dry. And what I wanted to do today was to get into discussion groups so we could start talking about our problems and our experiences in decision making. And I've talked about individuals and how they make decisions. I should just like to talk for 5 minutes about groups and how they make decisions. And let me just give you, first of all, in relation to when people come together as a group in a meeting, my rules for how meetings should be run. And I've tried to condense them to 5. Now, meetings are the bane of my life. I probably have gone to more meetings than I've had meals. First of all, I try not to go to a meeting that doesn't have a defined purpose. Right? Too often you get people who just want to get together to talk about something, but they don't have a real reason in their minds for why. They haven't identified why they're meeting. Secondly, if you're going to have a meeting, let's have an agenda so that we can look at it systematically. Nothing worse than not having an agenda. And thirdly, when you have a meeting, have those people there who are relevant to the decision-making process. Now, they don't have to necessarily be the ones who just make the decision. They may be the people who implement the decision. But there's nothing worse than having all sorts of hangers-on when you're having meetings. And so it's important to only have the relevant people there. Fourthly, it really does help, particularly for community-based groups, that if you're going to make decisions, to try and get people to write down prior to the meeting on paper what it is that they want decided and why and so on. That goes through that process with real recommendations so that you can get a handle on what it is that people are trying to say, what they want to do. And finally, after you've gone through whatever the dynamics are of making a decision, you write down what it is you've decided and you keep a record of it. Right? And then you know what it is and who it is, what it is you've decided and who's responsible for doing it. Because there's nothing worse than coming back to the next meeting and say, well, what did we decide last meeting? And weren't you going to do that? Oh, I thought you were going to do it. Now, it happens in all organisations from the highest to the lowest in the land that those 5 rules, if we only did those and nothing else, we'd actually make some progress. Finally, I want to talk about organisations and their dynamics. Now, this is such a large topic that I could not possibly talk about it today in any sensible way because it really leads to strategic planning, corporate planning and so on. All large organisations have to do it. But it's the sort of thing that I now want you to start talking about as a group, because the first part that's important is to be able to say very clearly what it is that the group or the organisation is on about. Now, if you haven't got that kind of statement which everybody understands and can relate to, you'll find an organisation which is drifting, its members are confused and generally unproductive. Now, I remember seeing an interview with a man called Ian Burgess, who was a managing director of a very large company, and he was being asked about what it was that he was going to try and achieve, and they were saying to him, well, are you going to do what your reputation suggests is, and that is cut a lot of jobs from this organisation? He said, no, I'm not on about cutting jobs. He says, I'm actually in the process of creating real jobs. The interviewer didn't pick him up at that point as to what he meant by a real job, but later on he explained, when he was asked what his real goal for the organisation was, and he said it's 2 things. And he said it in crystal clear language, which was very blunt: to create profits and cash. And he says, and if a job doesn't contribute to those 2 things, it's not a real job. So he closed the discussion. Now, that's pretty hard-headed kind of business talk, but it occurred in the context of the crash, when there were plenty of Australian companies which were making profits, but they had no cash. And many of the profits were based on shares, which value disappeared overnight, and so they folded. And so he had got a real grasp on what his organisation was about. Now, I don't suggest for one moment that Christian organisations are based on profits and cash. But if you can state very clearly what it is that you're activity, your enterprise, your organisation is on about, then the chances are you'll be able to achieve that particular goal. Good, well, thank you very, very much for this opportunity.